Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
The Prime Minister, Kuo Zhu, and he lived in the Tang Dynasty, was an outstanding statesman. He was a distinguished general, and he was one of the most admired national heroes of his day. Now, his fame and his wealth and his power and his success didn't distract him from his very keen, deep interest and his devotion to Zen. Regarding himself as a very plain and humble, devoted individual, he very often visited his favorite Zen master to study with him. Now, he and this Zen master, they seemed to get along very well. The fact that he was a prime minister seemed to have no influence on their situation, this association. There was no noticeable trace of politeness on the part of the Zen master, nor was there any of this vain loftiness on the part of the minister. The association seemed to be purely religious, that of a revered master and teacher and an obedient disciple. One day, however, when he was paying this usual visit to this Zen master, this general, this prime minister, he asked a question. And he says, "Your Reverence, how does Zen explain egotism?" And suddenly, this Zen master's face turned blue, And in a very haughty and very contemptuous tone of voice, he said, "What are you saying, you numbskull?" And this really unreasonable, and very unexpected defiance so hurt the feelings of the prime minister that this slight sullen expression began to creep over his face. This little bit of anger, it showed. And the Zen master, he then smiled and he said, "Your Excellency, this is ego." This is ego. It's a big problem. Our ego function is a very basic problem, and much more so than most people realize. To function in this world, we need the ego. But to discover what we truly are, then the ego is the biggest stumbling block. Now next week, starting next Sunday night, the week of session, sesshin, we're going to have no talking, no communicating with one another except in emergencies and very dire circumstances and so on and so on. So there will be lots of opportunities for you to perceive egotism. Really. And that's part of what these rules and regulations are for. So you can observe yourself rather than observing the other guy. You can observe yourself in reaction and you're responding and so on and so on. Now, because, many people, and I don't know how many of you here do this, but many people live with the notion that the ego is a little something that hides in here and peeks its head out every once in a while to get us into trouble, you know. And then, of course, others, they think about this ego as this myself, this myself that I'm dealing with every day, in every way. You know? And it's not getting any better. Could this myself be the ego? Could it be? Then I jolly well better find this real self or this true identity. But then comes the question, how? I am so caught up in this world, in this pseudo-self, in this ego, this myself, I don't really know where to look. All I see is myself, you know. I don't know how to look. How does one seek the self, the true self? Yeah. Well, let's say, take a child. Child is born. And a child is born without any information, objectively speaking. Now, it's very wise, but it has no information, and it certainly doesn't know that it's wise. He has no information about himself. And because of this, we say he is born tabula rasa, with a clean slate. He has no information in his mind. It's being questioned today that this tabula rasa is not true. You know, that he's being born with tendencies, so he's not pure. You know, he's not all this clean. But if you really study the thing, there is nothing in the psyche. There is nothing in the mind. There is no content to consciousness. It is his body that responds, you see, at the beginning. The mind has accumulated nothing as yet, simply because he is not aware of himself, and he has not met other. Also, the first thing he becomes aware of is not himself. No. He becomes aware, first of all, of other. Other. Food comes from out there. Doesn't rise in him. It comes from out there. Bath comes from out there. He gets clean from out there. Love comes from out there. And as the eyes begin to focus, you know, the eyes move out. The hands move out. Everything is out there, you know, other than me. Other, it's other. Oh, he doesn't know this is all his world at this time, you know. So, the tongue tastes. The ears hear. You know, the nose twitches with aromas. Out there. Our senses move out. Always out, and so we are caught out there. We are born into this world, and it is for us a world out there, a world seemingly out there. Then, little by little, he becomes aware of a person. Later on, he will call her mother. Little by little, he becomes aware of his own body. You know, he looks at his hand, and he gurgles with it, and oh, isn't that something? But it's not his. It's out there. It's other to him. You know, but it is such a tremendous discovery. You know, all through this, you know, little things happening, chewing on things, and then it hurts, you know, sometimes he hurts himself with the things he chews on. But little by little, he begins to be aware of himself. He becomes aware of others, and then in contrast to other, he becomes aware of me. Now that's the road we've all come. Other, and then me. Now, for a long, long time, this baby me, that is other and me, I and thou, you know. Mm-hmm. The awareness of me in contrast to awareness of other, this is a reflected awareness. First, he is aware only of his mother. He's not aware of what he is. He's aware of his mother and what she thinks about him. Because of the mother he is, in the contrast. If mother smiles, if she appreciates the child, if she says to it, "You are beautiful," and if she hugs him and kisses him, the child feels very good about himself. If she ignores him and doesn't think much about him, the child doesn't feel good about himself. So, either way, though, loving, lovingly attentive, or ignoring, the ego comes into its own. It reflects. There is a reflection in us. Through appreciation, through love and care, he feels he is good. He feels he is valuable. He feels he is of some significance. And something like a center begins to build. And this is the reflective center. What others think. And if a mother is sharp, she will observe her child to find out something about herself, because that's all he's doing for a while, is simply reflecting her. She has to be very objective to do this, of course, which most women aren't. A man can be much more objective than a woman. Now, if the mother thinks that the child is of no use, and nobody appreciates him, and nobody smiles, this is also what is reflected. It is what we call an ill ego. It's sad. He's rejected. He feels inferior. He's worthless. That's what his center then reflects. So if we go too far in any direction in the treatment of a child, the ego becomes ill. You can become too attentive, and you can ignore too much. And either way, this reflection becomes ill. So Mama walks just a very, very fine line. And it's too bad mothers aren't trained that this is the case. Yeah. And then pretty soon father enters the picture. And the same thing happens all over again. The father supports the child, loves him, or he rejects him. Usually the father says, "Well, I want to rear a strong, affectionate, valuable human being." And he sets the kid on the chair and says, "Shut up." You know, strange things we do. But anyway, first the mother. In the beginning, the mother. The child must learn to know his mother. And then the father. Now, when we begin in our later years, when we mature a little bit, and we begin to try to find this true self, same thing. First the mother. We learn to know the mother. Then, through the mother, the father can be approached. We live in the mother. You know, just as the child lives in the aura of the mother and her influence, we live in the mother, because we are, after all, part and parcel of nature. And the great mother, she's called, you know. And for a child, mother is the beginning. Whether you take it on a personal level or we take it later on when the person begins to look. This is the beginning. Mother is the beginning. So, then, as a child grows up, however, with his reflective center, others begin to enter in, and his world grows and grows and grows, and it becomes very complex because he discovers others do not think alike. Huh? They all seem to have different opinions. How can this be? You know? They have likes and dislikes, and they're not compatible. So it's all very complex. And now this ego, very complex, because all of these opinions are reflected. And it's all reflection. It is an accumulation of phenomena. See? The accumulation of phenomena, it is a byproduct of living with others. If a child lived totally alone, he might never have any ego to any great extent, but he would remain quite animal-like. And of course, never having developed this reflective ego, he could never come to know the true self. That real, true self can be known only through passing through this ego, passing through the pseudo-self. So ego is a must. We have to know other, then we can know me. Then we look at other within ourselves, because this is all reflection, and then from that reflection, again, now to an I. First, we have to know what is not true. We have to learn to meet it. We become aware that we're living a myth and that we live in an illusion, a reflection, and we learn that we do have deluded minds, as sharp as we may be and as sharp as we may think we are. We still have, it's a deluded mind, you know. But through a discipline, if you come to know the false as false, then suddenly truth opens her eyes and she smiles on you. Yeah. Now let's say this child becomes an adult. He's a mature person now. He wants to know something about himself, really. And he begins to question, this whole thing where he finds himself, this world. And he says, what am I doing here? Who am I? And where did I come from? Where am I going? And he's told he will find the answers to these questions in religion. So he begins to look around for a suitable religion, usually suitable to what he already thinks. And so in a way, he kind of tricks himself. He's looking for an easy way. He doesn't want any conflict. And there being more than 300, I think it's pretty close to 400 religious sects in the world, which is going to be most valuable out of them? Besides, we don't really have time to look, do we, through that many. So, now within the realm of science, scientists more or less look at things in a similar manner. So they have said that science as such is one. It's divided into all its many aspects, like biology, anatomy, neurology, astronomy, physics, astrophysics, you name it. But all of this is under an umbrella, which is called science. And science has been looking in the Western world, since the Ionian days in Greece, looking for a fundamental matter, a fundamental source. And they finally, you know, came upon the atom theory, that they finally found an atom and that couldn't be divided anymore, so that was the thing that held for a long time. But when we come now from turn from science to religion, with these almost 400 sects, all looking for a fundamental truth, are they? Are all of these nearly 400 sects looking for a fundamental truth? Then we begin, you know, we look around and we finally realize there are sects and there is religion. See, truth also is one, and truth is universal. And so that if one looks at it, that the source is one, then religion becomes one. One religion. Meister Eckhart belonged to this religion. The Buddha belonged to this religion. Jesus belonged to this religion. To religion, huh? Mohammed, Ramanuja, Nagarjuna, Bodhidharma, Chuang Tzu, Lao Tzu, Rinzai, Dogen, Hakuin Zenji, you know, and then we've got Jikuen Kugai. And Tian Li. Yeah. To religion as such. There is a fundamental source. There is a fundamental truth. And the great traditions hold to it. And the little sects vary from it. The traditions all have different approaches, and with a few of them, you have to get way inside before you can even see that what they're approaching is similar to something else. But under all, or overall, there is this everlasting light, and it is the light that lighteth every man. Never mind the buttons or the bows. You know, the sects have divided. Should you tie your shoes or should you button your shoes? You know, what difference does it make? Do you wear any shoes at all? Jesus was crucified on a cross. It was a very large, heavy, wooden cross. And not too many years later, there were bishops around the Mediterranean and in Rome and in Athens wearing gold crosses around their necks. This is society. This is what it can do with man's search for himself, the difference. We accumulate trappings, which we think are essential. So in a manner of speaking, it is our society itself that creates or helps to create this ego. It is the ambience in which we live. It is the atmosphere in which we exist. And this atmosphere in which we live is encompassing, you know, and it can be controlled, and it can be manipulated, and we are reflecting all of this. You know. Have you ever seen a society that could manipulate or control the true self? It stands aside, you know. Now, this child we're talking about, you and me, we need a center. We're not yet aware of our true center. We're very busy learning how to live in this kind of an atmosphere, this out there, this world. And when the time comes, when it is built enough, all of a sudden, the urge comes, and we turn around, and we want to look in here. So the child, you know, as he grows up, he goes to school, and he comes home, and he tells his parents he's first in class. The whole family's very happy. They're hugging and kissing him and so on, and father pats him on the back and says, "You are a pride to us." And mother says, "What a beautiful, dutiful child," you know. And it's such an ego buildup. Oh, he feels so good, and he's so satisfied. He can step out into this world of out there now with some self-assurance, with some confidence in himself. But if the child comes home and he's dejected and he's not successful, he's a failure, he couldn't pass, and he sits on a back porch and nobody appreciates him, his ego is very shaken, you know, and he begins to also reject himself. This is now, in the reflection, he rejects himself. Now we have got a real barrel of monkeys to overcome. He is rejecting himself. We see these people, they are constantly asking for attention. Oh, in very subtle ways, we have learned very subtle ways to do this. This pay attention to me, this look at me, just tell me I'm okay. And then they have sometimes this superiority. It's a kind of a stance in their inferiority. They're covering it. And you can see it in the way they hold themselves, in the way they speak, and in the way they don't speak. It's just the way they hold themselves. It's there. See? And finally, if they've got smarts enough, they wind up in Zen. And all that's taken away, little by little, huh? That's what teacher's for. To try to arrange, if possible, situations in order for us to see ourselves. For usually, not always, but usually, when people see themselves, they will drop the contents of the psyche that they don't like, that they have looked at now. And they realize they're simply reflecting family and society. And in dropping that, in seeing it and dropping it, it allows them to become a real person, you know, an individual responsible for himself, to himself. Which, after all, you know, is a mark of maturity, isn't it? This responsibility for oneself. And sometimes this is the problem between husbands and wives. A man can be very successful in the business world, and he works very hard, and he has very little time to give to his wife. And she thinks she's not getting enough attention. There is always seems to be something more important than me. And so she feels rejected. Sometimes, nowadays, it's the woman who succeeds. And the husband doesn't know how to act with this reversal of roles. You know, that she is more important out there than he is. And this is difficult for some men to deal with. He begins to ask for attention, just as if it were the opposite, she asks for attention, which is done very subtly, but very often leads to arguments. You know, it's like one time our monk, you know, our monk, that we dump all kinds of things on this monk. He and his wife had been at a cocktail party, and as we all know, the beverages served at a cocktail party sometimes loosen the tongue. You know, inhibitions are dropped. The censor has disappeared. for a little while. But they're going home and they're walking along the road. So this monk says to his wife, "Darling, has anyone ever said to you how fascinating and how beautiful and how wonderful you are?" Huh! This made her feel so good, you know. She was so happy. He had never, ever said anything like this before. And she knew she finally had his attention. So she looked up at him through her lashes and batting her baby browns. Very coyly, she tells him, "I wonder why no one has ever told me this before." So the monk looks at her and he says, "Well, then where did you get the idea?" Bless her heart, huh? Well, so we have a center which society has given us. We've acquired it. It's shaped for us. We have a notion of who we are because of others. And this is not direct experience. Then there is a center with which you were born. It's given you by existence. Nobody shapes it. To know something within this center that has been given you is direct experience. Now, in order to see into this, to have this direct experience into the center given you, the ego center, the one shaped by society, must be displaced somehow or overcome for a period of time, be it 1 second or 1 minute or 2 minutes, enough to allow you to peer into the perceive, you know, into the depths of this center. And one glance of this direct experience will tell anyone how little he really knows about himself. Ego-wise or any otherwise, how little we really know. Being born in this world at a certain time in history, in the history of humanity, we all partake of a certain background. You know, the way the religionists, the sects, and the scientists believe. You know, it all forms our background, and we hardly ever recognize it as background, but it is the background in which we grow up and which we reflect. You know. And from this background, that we do not even cognize. We don't say, "Oh, that's the background in which I live." How often have you said that? No. From this background, we fashion our lives. We fashion how we live. And man, by and large, at this point in time, seems to be quite satisfied that he rules the earth. And he also feels he's much better off than his predecessors. After all, what did they know? They didn't really know about atoms. Not really. We know much more about them. We know that the atom is divisible. They didn't know that 2,500 years ago. Man as such has lived through many ages. And there was a physicist, and he classified these ages, and he called them the magic age and the mythic age, geometric, medieval, infinite, and mechanistic ages. and he called each of these ages a mask. It was a mask of the universe. It is how man sees the universe at a certain period in time. It is his mask, this background. The universe, he said, we don't know. We know the masks. And this, his name was Harrison, this physicist. He says that starting way, way back with a sort of a speculative and maybe fictional account of the magic universe, you know, and it's existed like hundreds of thousands of years ago. Now, scientists are putting it back that far. When Homo sapiens, that's wise men, huh? Us, we began to acquire advanced linguistic skills hundreds of thousands of years ago. The magic universe, an animistic world. That is, we endowed everything with an anima. That is living, and that is living, and that is living. We endowed it with a livingness. But to them, all the livingness, the things, they were vibrant with spirits. And the spirits were motivated by thoughts and by feelings of human beings, so that a human being could stand beside a bush and say bloom to the spirit that was inside, and the bush would bloom. Or it would say to another bush, die, and the bush would die. The spirits were motivated by what man thought and felt, seeing. Think of the world they lived in, you know. Spirits everywhere, in everything, huh? Hosts of spirits pervading our world. And their laws conform somewhat to ours, and their rules and regulations, you know. And they also had very primitive social codes, these people. And now, this Mr. Harrison said in this book that he left out the mystical, because in the magic world, there was not this mystical thing that we have today. But he said this magic applied simply to what originates in the human mind as to what activates out there. This primitive, meaning primary world that disappeared about 30,000 years ago. I might say one thing. You know, Aristotle, he is the father of our sciences and so on. He was an animist. He endowed things with an anima, a livingness. So it didn't altogether disappear 30,000 years ago. We're still holding some of it. I think if you really look inside of yourself, you know, you will see some of this. And then came the mythic universe and these magic beings that lived in the trees and in the rocks and so on were all assimilated into ascendant beings. They were now ruling over us from on high. Now some of this still survives, this mythic. It kind of reflects our order of social life, what they did then. And it rose about 10 to 20,000 years ago and reached its most advanced stages in Mesopotamia and Egypt and India. And see, 20,000 years ago, that's about the time the Vedas were written. Yeah. And the most advanced expression that this period of time had was in the Zoroastrian. We really should do a thing on it. Zoroastrian. By the grace of Constantine, Emperor Constantine, we didn't become. No. In those days, the cults were many. I think you sometimes say they were legion, huh? Many, 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 many. And this man, Constantine, wanted desperately to be the emperor. So he and the Christians made a deal. See, Christian at that time was just another little sect along with everything else. Zoroaster was a big one. They made a deal with him. If he would become a Christian, they could altogether overcome Zoroastrian, and they would make him emperor. And this is what happened. And so he decreed when he became emperor that everybody should become a Christian for Christians. Not by our own choice. Our choices are not always what they seem. This is simply the background into which we have been born. Yeah. And this background that we have now of this, not now, but the mythic universe, we bought at a stiff price. You know. The world of what we call matter, the rocks and the trees and the clouds, all became spiritless. It was dead. We live in a world of dead matter. Instead of all this vibrancy, dead matter. And now out of this then, our world, this mask was riven, you know, cut in two by the dualists, good and evil, huh? Soul and flesh, free and predestined, you know, divine kingship, the tyranny of it, you know, the appeasement to the gods by human sacrifice, you know, the massacre and the enslavement of nations that worshipped other gods, couldn't tolerate it. Then we witnessed the rise of science. They rejected the gods. The development, you know, of the Ionian scientists and philosophers, Pythagoras and Aristotelian systems, Do you think that in this present day, we have arrived at the final mask, the final belief of this universe? Is our modern universe, you know, and we're confronted in it with the problems of rocks and trees and clouds. But it's coming to be no longer dead matter. It's going to be rocks and trees and clouds and observer. It all boils down to observer. Whatever you see has any meaning to you. What you hear has meaning to you. So the world that is coming more and more and more will be trees and rocks and clouds and observer. Not necessarily me, just observer. And this has started only back about 20 years ago. And this man says, and already we sail the perilous seas where the universe in which we live is recognized as reconstructions of the mind brain. And it was Eddington, as another scientist who had a tendency toward being a philosopher, and he wrote, and I think all of you are familiar with this, we have found, now he's speaking of scientists, we have found a strange footprint on the shores of the unknown. We have devised profound theories, one after another, to account for its origin. And at last we have succeeded in reconstructing the creature that made that footprint, and lo, it is our own. Our mind, it is so near and so dear and so full of all kinds of intellectual nonsense that we have from our mask. It's also full of passionate rubbish, sentiments. And I will say that some of it is very useful for our daily life. There's just no denying that. But because of these accumulations, we're miserable. It's like we're in a trap. And we feel like we're under some kind of bondage. And we want nothing more than just some freedom and some naturalness and some spontaneity. And we don't seem to get it. Now, Zen masters in Japan, they know this. They have gone through the same wearying experience. They know that we are so immersed in our own construction, reconstruction of the universe, that comprehension for the real does not come easily. The truth of Zen can never be attained unless one comes to it with one's whole effort. The climb up the mountain is very slippery. It is not a childish pastime. It is the most serious task that you can undertake in your life, and it is lifelong. And in this search, we find this climb up the mountain, that we all have our values. They're given us, and some of them we picked up along the way because we liked them, we've acquired them. Some are buried very deeply, so deep we don't even know they're there. We need to sit and look just within, you know, so they will rise. You know, it's called digging them up, and you just observe. And they'll rise. Huh? And then we can reevaluate some of these values in the light of day. We can say to ourselves, when a value comes to mind, why do I hold such and such a value? Why? And then trace it back. Why? And we find in so doing that the values that have an egotistic source, we find them ugly. These are ugly values. And we find also that they usually go against the welfare of humanity. Let's not forget that this little ego, or big ego, or medium-sized ego, is a mischief maker. A value has no value when it is not subjectively free from egotistical impulses. When a value is free from the ego, it is just so. Just so. You know what, just so? It has no value. It is just so. It's Lao Tzu says it very well. Anything that can be named, you know, anything that can be designated as this or that is not Tao. The very moment that you say it is good, the good loses its goodness. The really good is just so. Just so. It's no more and it's no less. It's just so. For instance, when God saw the world that was created in response to his fiat, you know, when he said, let there be light. And he saw this light, and he nodded, and he said, yes, that's good. This good has nothing whatsoever to do with our human way of evaluating. This good, the term that he uses, is the isness of things, the essence of things. It is not something added. If you add something, it becomes a value less. But this good is just so. Just so. The value of something is something inherent. What is beautiful does not claim for itself that it is beautiful. If it is beautiful and it stands before, you don't hear that rose shrieking, look at me, I'm beautiful. It just stands before us and we all know it's beautiful. The moment anything says, any of us say, I am beautiful, all of a sudden, right up nose against it, there is the ego, and everybody drops their head in shame. And you know that. And Lao Tzu said, when a beauty makes display of beauty, it becomes sheer ugliness. Yeah. So beauty is just so. A human value is just so. Just so. Don't make anything more out of it. It's a lot easier to live with just so. It is good. It is just so. It is just good. It is just so. Now, when you, in your practicing, you know, whatever you're doing outside in the world, you stand aside of that doing for a moment. You know, you can do and stand there and watch. And you look and you observe. You watch what you're doing. You know, if you really watch, it won't be long before you can see the source of your misery, of your anguish. No. And if you don't, why, you come to me and I'll help you. But if you're going to observe, then observe. I mean, really observe. Just don't say, I'm observing, I'm watching. And as long as you say the words, you think you're doing it. Rather not say the words and do it. Just saying it doesn't amount to anything. Because I mean observe. Observe yourself. And when we question ourselves, which we should do, you know, we had a whole boom boom of that last week. We don't ask ourselves a lot of philosophical questions. No. We need a very direct approach to ourselves. And that's what happened now with this Zen master and his prime minister. He wanted to make a direct impression. And so he made his face turn blue. That's a good art. Can you make your face turn blue? Red, yeah, but not blue. And then in this very haughty and contemptuous manner, he says, what are you doing, you numbskull? And everything has changed. Immediately, everything has changed. This minister is being brought down to earth with a thud. You know, there's his feet now. And now he knows he has to look at himself. He knows that. He has to look at this ego, which prior to this moment, he may have only speculated about, as we all do. Speculation is not direct looking. Yeah. Now, see, he's been given this gift. It is his to deal with. Yeah. And, you know, there are a lot of people that are fearful of dealing with themselves, of dealing with their values, of dealing with their ego. But there was this very great Zen master in China. And again, he lived in the Tang Dynasty. It was a terrific dynasty for the growth of religion. And it is said that he lived to be about 120 years of age. He didn't start looking for his religion until he was 60. And he was enlightened when he was 80. And he lived to be 120. And his name was Joshu. Yeah. And in the monastery, the Joshu is famous for the Mu. In the monastery where he lived, there was a stone bridge that was known all over the empire. And at one day, a visiting monk came and asked Joshu, "We hear so much of your stone bridge. I look at it, and I see it to be no more than a rickety old log bridge falling apart. Rickety." And Joshu answered, "You just see the log bridge, and you do not see the stone one?" And the monk says, "Well, what then is the stone bridge?" And Joshu says, "Horses pass over it, and asses pass over it." Yeah, there is a stone bridge. Why do we all stand on it? Okay. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.